Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Before we get started today, I have a favor to ask our listeners. Caroline is turning 85 on June 8th, 2020. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that Caroline loves sending and receiving mail. So we would like to ask you to send a birthday card. We're making it a surprise, so send it to Caroline Kilborn, care of Monica Hadley, P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. That's P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Thank you, and now on with the show. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone, wherever you are. I hope that you're safe and well, and I hope the sun is shining in your area.
And, or it's raining if you need rain.
Yeah, right.
Although there's some parts...
Yeah, supposed to get a whole week of rain next week. I'm not looking forward to that.
Some parts of our country right now we're having issues with flooding. I think up in the upper Midwest, there's dams that broke. And yeah, it's. But we're going to sunny California today, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
So, Mom, who do we have with us today?
Well, today we have an author whose name is Phyllis Melhado, and she is the former Vice President of Public Relations for Estee Lauder. She has been published in Town & Country, Cosmopolitan, and the Scarlet Leaf Review. She has also ghosted a best-selling beauty book, as well as a nationally syndicated beauty column. She earned her master's degree in communications from NYU and lives in New York City. And The Spa at Lavender Lane, which is the name of her book, is her first novel, and it's a good one.
Well, welcome to Writer's Voices, Phyllis.
Thank you, and I just love what your mother just said, that it was a good one.
Oh, it
That's
is.
That's a great
it
way
is.
To begin.
Yes, that is true. So, but tell us a little bit about the novel. Like, it's a kind of a little bit of romance, a little bit of... It's contemporary.
It's kind of like me. It just looks like a little bit of everything.
Yeah, really.
You know, the publisher wanted to categorize it as a romance, and they said, no, it's women's fiction. It has romance in it. Yeah. It has friendship. A lot of people who've read it have picked up on that very much.
Yeah, that was the important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And female empowerment.
Yes.
These women... Mm-hmm. Come to find their power, and they move forward with that. And that's very important for us and for also the men who read it. They need to know who we are.
And you actually
and deal with
a lot of different female relationships in here. Like you said, friendships, women to women, mother-daughter, mentor-mentee.
Yes.
Yeah, there's quite a – you're covering quite a lot of ground.
It's interesting, I guess. You know, every once in a while you see a very young writer who comes out with a fantastic book, and I always think, how in the world could they do that? They haven't lived. You know, they haven't had experiences. So I'm at the other end in my second career and have had a lot of experiences, and have met so many people.
Well, you know,
especially women... Yeah.
Another one of our guests recently had said that too, that she couldn't have written this book when she was younger. And do you feel the same way, that you couldn't have written this when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I've been writing my whole life. My mother, actually, rest her soul, taught me to read and write before I even got to kindergarten. And I was an only child and was absolutely just immersed in books. She would take me to the big library every Friday, and it was like going to a candy store to pick out the books that I wanted to have. I just loved it, always have, and I still feel that way when I go into a bookstore. And please, I hope they open soon.
Oh, I know.
It's nothing so delicious as to walking in and looking at these beautiful titles and and picking them up and reading a few words to see if you like the style and reading about the story and about the author. It's just wonderful. So I could not, back to your original question, could never have written this as a younger person. I actually did write another novel. I'm an overnight sensation. It's only taken me 100 years to get here. I wrote another novel, which, not quite, but I'm moving up there. Another novel some time ago when I first broke away to start to write, and was very excited because a big agent signed me, and a publisher was interested, and I had the publisher lunch and the whole thing. And then it mysteriously went away, and I never found out why they changed their mind. Mm-hmm. So this is not my first novel per se. It's my first published novel. And then I wrote another book, which is actually a true story. Spent 4 years on it and traveled quite a bit abroad in Dubai and Italy to do interviews, and that didn't happen because there were legal concerns. So I've paid some dues, and I had to take myself to the spa. It was the only thing I could do to be to be in that environment. You know? Yeah.
Well, a couple things, comments. First of all, yes. I know exactly what you mean about being totally immersed in books as a child. I was one of five children, but mom can tell you some stories. I'm sure.
I bet.
I never went anywhere without a book, and going to the library was a huge thrill. And just like you said, like being in a candy store, we lived in this tiny town,
wonderful.
And it had a tiny library, but I loved going, and it was only open maybe one day a week or something like that, but I loved going there. But then there was the bookmobile from the big city library from Lancaster, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We lived in a small town outside of Lancaster. And that
way, I grew up in Philadelphia. Oh my goodness. We can talk about that.
Yes.
Pretzels.
Oh,
yeah,
for sure.
Right.
And of course, one of the best pretzels there are her pretzels.
Yes.
And that was
H-E-R-R. Yes.
And that was my maiden name. So we didn't my family didn't own the pretzel factory. There's also,
I was going to say, I wish I had known you back then.
There was also the Herr potato chips, which are some of the best potato chips.
Oh, my
God.
Yes, right. I love it.
Yep. So,
and not to forget Stutz candies.
Ooh,
that's from around that way, isn't
right.
it?
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So, we're going to talk about everything but books today.
But I did want to mention about independent bookstores, that during this time when you can't go get into the bookstore, you can order from bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores.
And there's another one my publisher told me about called IndieBound.
Yes.
I think I've
heard of that one too. So that's two great ways to get books. And you know, we all know the big e-commerce bookseller,
right?
But
yes, of course we do,
and you know, and bless them because they get a lot of books in a lot of people's hands. But if you would really like to keep bookstores alive, bookstore.org or IndieBound are great ways to get your books.
And I was to have had a wonderful reading at a bookstore not far from my home called Shakespeare and Company.
Oh, yeah.
And I was so disappointed when, for so many reasons, when all of this business happened. Because, of course, it was canceled. But hopefully we'll come out of this and people can go to bookstores again.
Isn't there a Shakespeare and Company in Paris? Was that the original one?
Yes, there is.
Yes.
Absolutely is.
And when I was in Paris, I went there and I bought a book.
Good. I know there's one in Philadelphia, too.
Oh, wow.
And there are a couple here in New York. I don't know about anywhere else in the country, but they're wonderful shops, and we'll see them with their doors open soon. But as you said, people can support these local bookstores by ordering from those venues, which is great.
Yes. So back to the spa at Lavender Lane.
Yes.
You had a career in the beauty industry. Did that take
I did.
You
yes.
to a lot of spas? Is this a familiar place
it,
for
it,
you?
It did. It did in that for two reasons. One, at Estee Lauder, we opened what were called in-store spas. And they were small little alcoves or specialty rooms where people could get manicures, pedicures, what have you. And people are now calling little nail salons spas, which kind of annoys me because those aren't really spas. Spas are resorts or getaway places where you can really unwind and relax. And in my nearly 20 years at Estee Lauder, which was an amazing job, I did work very hard and very long hours and traveled a lot. And I could rarely carve out a real vacation. There was just too much going on. And so what I found myself doing was tacking on a day or so at the end of a week away somewhere. And that's how I really got to learn about spas. So if I was in California, which I went to quite a bit, I went to La Costa, and there was another one in Northern California, not far in the wine country, the name escapes me. And then I've been to Canyon Ranch a couple of times. And then there are a couple of places not far from the New York area, which I was able to go to for a long weekend. One in Connecticut, and a wonderful place near Poughkeepsie called Mohonk Mountain House, which has been there. It's like in the fifth generation of this family. It's almost like summer camp for grown-ups. It's this big, old, wonderful house with a wonderful lake and swimming and boating and terrific, healthful food and horseback riding. And just a wonderful, easy place to go to. And so that was my spa fascination. And indeed, when I finally left my job, which was not easy to do, I went to Canyon Ranch for a nice stay to clear my mind. And I guess my experiences of going to these places sat with me and said, well, you know, this would be a fun place to set a story. I never met any of these women in the spa. Indeed, nobody in the book is anybody.
Well,
that's the first thing people
okay.
ask me. Is anybody in me? Am I in? People say, am I in the book?
Okay.
No, you're not in the book.
But Phyllis, from what you just told me,
yeah.
it seems like maybe Tony is a little bit you.
Yeah, one of the characters
yes.
left her job.
Oh, you picked
yeah.
up on that.
Yes.
I was just about to say, she is a little bit me. Yes, for sure.
Yes.
And I did, well, I started with Madame Demidova, and there was a woman who I came in more than in contact with, was close 2 years ago. One of my first jobs in advertising, I was a copywriter, and then small agency where you had to do everything, and so I was like a junior account executive, owned a very elegant exercise salon for well-to-do ladies on the Upper East Side on 68th Street between Madison and Fifth. And she happened to have been Russian. But that's where the similarity ends. But I think that I got the idea for an older Russian lady from that. But it's funny because her name was Manya, wonderful woman, and she took a shine to me. And I had to do the classes in order to be able to write about her methods. And indeed, she wrote a book, which I helped with, too. And so I would go and do all the exercises, and then she'd say, well, wait for me, and we'll leave together. And then she would take me to this wonderful restaurant, which in its heyday was a mecca for New York literary and theatrical types, called the Russian Tea Room.
I've heard of that.
So oh, yes, it was quite well known. You could go there on a Friday and see everybody from Helen Gurley Brown to Woody Allen. It was just a marvelous place. So Manya would take me there, and here I'm trying to keep my weight down, and she would feed me chicken Kiev and pierogies and baklava and all this fattening food, which was really funny. But that is where the idea of the doyen of the spa, that's where that came from. But Tony is the most like me, except I did not have that sort of relationship with my best friend.
Ah, right.
No.
Well, that might be a little more 21st century.
Yes.
That might have been a little unusual in the 20th century.
I don't know. Our listeners don't know what we're talking about.
No,
I don't know. Shall we tell them or let them be surprised?
We could tell them because it's pretty early in the book. I don't think it's really a spoiler.
Okay. Yeah. So Tony had a very big job. She was a head buyer, sportswear designer buyer at a posh Fifth Avenue store, which I gave the name Gillum's. And her very best friend was, is, I should talk in the present tense, is a designer. And he's quite a character, and he happens to be gay. And they've been best friends since college. And she kind of freaked out because she hit her 40th birthday and had a revelation that she really wanted to have a child after all, after thinking for a very long time that she didn't. And Kevin, her gay best friend, also wanted to be a father and witnessed Anderson Cooper just becoming a father. It's more and more common for gay men to exercise that desire to have children. So they decided, because they really did love each other and would always be together in a kind of a family, that they would parent, they would have a biological child together and raise that child together. So, but they actually do it the old-fashioned way instead of with a test tube. So it was kind of fun. I don't know where I came up with that one, but that's the fun of being a writer. That's the fun of being a writer. You're allowed to come up with stuff.
Sure. So,
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. So her secret going there, a lot of them have secrets, is that she can't talk about the baby because it's early on, and so many women don't carry past 3 months, unfortunately. And she didn't want to jinx it, so she was trying to keep that a secret.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Phyllis Milhado, author of The Spa at Lavender Lane. Now, Phyllis, one of the characters is a former supermodel, and another character is a wannabe model.
Yes.
You have some experience in the modeling world yourself.
Yes, I do. Both myself, I did a little bit of modeling when I was young, and it really wasn't for me. I had a pretty strong academic background, and but I wanted to try it. I had a summer job at the Hollywood Pavilion at the 1964 New York World's Fair. And I fell in with a bunch of young actors and actresses, and they all pushed me. So I did a little modeling, and then it's almost a cliche, came up with a rather unpleasant character in the garment business. And if it had been the Me Too movement, I would have been a heroine. But I walked, yes. I'm not sure if I smacked him or was just nasty in return, but he had his hands on me. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, he was adjusting the material. Well, the material was inside my shirt, you know? Mm. So I said something to him, and he said, gave me that, "Well, you'll never work in this town again." I mean, it really a cliche. And I said, "That's fine with me." And that's when I went to graduate school. right after that.
Well, congratulations.
So that was my thank you.
Yeah, that was a good decision.
Absolutely. That was my personal experience. But then, of course, in my job, I worked with the most beautiful models, starting with Karen Graham, who was the one woman most associated with Estee Lauder early on. People actually thought she was Estee Lauder. That's when the ads were these magnificent portrayals of elegant life. Women standing by a collection of priceless candelabra and in a country estate with a white horse in the background and in impossible places, very aspirational. So she was the model for a very long time. And then who was next? It was Karen. I think it was Paulina. I think Paulina was next, who was extraordinary looking. To this day, she's a beautiful woman. And she was the Estee Lauder model for a very long time. Oh, I'm sorry. Before Paulina, it was Willow Bay. Willow was a very, very bright woman, and she had had broadcasting experience. And now, as a matter of fact, she's the dean of communications at USC, I think, University of Southern California.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, she has great, great academic credentials, plus the fact she is married to Robert Iger, who is the president of ABC Disney. So she did okay on both accounts.
Somebody could write a book about her. Yeah.
I know. She's reading my book now. I'm so excited. Send it to her, and she said, oh, no, she would order it.
Aww.
So there was Willow. And when she was ready for graduate school, I wrote letters of recommendation because she went to NYU, and since I graduated, it was good. Then after that, we had Paulina, who is she told me she was writing her memoir, and she should, because she's had a very interesting life. She's also a very bright girl, but she was born in Czechoslovakia, and her parents were politically active and not, I guess they were anti-communist, and she was shipped off to live with some relative in Sweden. So here she is, Czech-born, grew up in Sweden, and she ended up in the United States. I'm not sure how. But she's quite bright, and she wrote a novel a couple of years ago called Model Summer, I believe. And she and I are still in touch. She read the book, and she loved it. She gave me a shout-out on her Instagram, which in today's world is really, really important.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, I'm old school. I have to have somebody help me do all that stuff.
Oh, that's okay.
To me, important is being on a show with you ladies. That's what I know. And Vogue and Harper's Bazaar. I don't know about, too much about social media, except it's terribly important. So I have help with doing that. And let's see, Elizabeth Hurley also has read the book and said she liked it very much. She's an English actress who was the model after Paulina. So I had to have a lot of courage to have my photograph taken with these ladies. I mean, they are one is more gorgeous than the next. It's unbelievable.
Well, Phyllis, the model in Spa at Lavender Lane, the former model who's trying to make a comeback,
yes,
doesn't come off very well. She's not the most
likable
person.
No,
so
she's
not.
It
doesn't sound like you're patterning her.
It's not like
patterning her off.
No, it's not like it's not like my model friends. They're all very, very nice women. I have known some models that were not so nice, and a couple of actresses that were not so nice, and I think I infused her with those characteristics.
So
there is one thing that she does, though, that was me. I have to be honest about that. When she has a manicure and the woman goes to clip her cuticles and she snaps at her, didn't I tell you not to clip my cuticles? I did that one time, and the poor manageress looked at me. She was so hurt because that's not who I am at all. But I was told by a doctor never to have my cuticles cut because it's not good for your fingers or your fingernails.
Oh, so, wow. So why do they do it?
Yeah. They do it because it gives a sharper, cleaner edge, and I think they can put the polish on more carefully. I don't know. I've done my nails now myself for such a long time. But as far as Mavis is concerned, she was the most fun to write. I mean, she was so calculating and so self-centered and selfish. And so I had fun writing her, but she's not really any one person. But there were models that were not so nice, but I knew many, many lovely, lovely models.
Now, Phyllis, you mentioned that you worked in advertising early on in your career.
Yes.
So
yes, I did.
Was that the Mad Men era?
Just at the tail end of
the
that.
The tail end of it?
I was definitely Peggy, the copywriter. Yeah. That stuff, I mean, the stuff that went on, all of what you saw in that show, I mean, it was not far from the truth. I only worked in a couple of small agencies, but it was a microcosm of that. There was a lot of sexism, a lot of hanky-panky. One agency I worked at, we had an art director, and I mean, I know he wasn't making that much money, and my God, he had a summer house and a boat and a sports car, and where in the heck did this come from? And we found out that we did a lot of catalog fashion. And, of course, that doesn't exist anymore. But what would happen was the manufacturers would supply the catalog company with printed sheets for them to bind in their catalog. So let's say it was Sears Roebuck for want of something else. If they put out a catalog and there were a section of men's and women's clothing, chances are that the manufacturers of the clothing would ship them these printed papers. Now, four-color printing is expensive, and so we found out that this guy was getting a kickback from the printer because he was commissioning a lot of work.
Ah, interesting.
Yes. And then in my very first job, and this was on Madison Avenue, just like Mad Men, I went out to dinner, and I left something in the office, and I went back to get it, and I walked in on something I never wanted to see. You can use your imagination. Okay. Oh, my, I will just tell you this much. One of our accounts had to do with jewelry, and all the woman was wearing was her jewelry.
Oh, okay. Well, scene could go in one of your books.
Yes, it could. Yes, it could.
Well, you have a wealth of possibilities here. You really do.
I am lucky in that I've had a lot of experiences. I've traveled a lot. I've always specialized in bad boys. And right now, the main bad boy in my life is a schnoodle. And if you hear a bark, that's because he's jealous. I'm not paying any attention to him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your involvement with the Pink Ribbon.
Well, in the Lauder family, which until, I want to say, it was 1995, I guess, owned the company totally. They totally owned the company. And it's public now. But there really was a Mrs. Estée Lauder, and she and her husband started the company in 1946. And they had two sons, the older of whom was my big boss named Leonard Lauder. He ran the company, and he went into the service right after college, and he came out of the service and went into the company business. And he married a lovely woman named Evelyn, who was a school teacher, and she also went into the business. Evelyn was very much involved in product development and was in the office constantly. She was a vice president. And when I first went to the company, my boss was mostly working with Estee and Leonard, and that I was working with Evelyn. And as I grew there, I worked with all the Lauder family. So, but Evelyn and I were particularly close. And one day, it was in 1993, she called me into her office and said that she wanted to do a fundraising luncheon to raise funds for breast cancer. And I knew at the time that, I shouldn't say I knew, I suspected at the time that there might have been a very personal reason that she did that. And I'm not quite sure of the timing, but we did ultimately find out that she did have breast cancer. But at any rate, so I arranged this luncheon for her, and to which she invited many of her very important friends. And she was in that ilk of society women who they all knew each other and they all supported one another's causes. The thing that set Evelyn apart was that she worked. I mean, she worked every day, where she was not a lady who lunched, as some of the ladies were. But I remember it was a lovely luncheon at Sign of the Dove, which was a restaurant on 3rd Avenue in the 60s in New York City. And that was the beginning of what is now a formidable organization called the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, which has garnered millions and millions of dollars for research and caring of cancer patients, and is allied with the doctors at Sloan Kettering. And she had a hospital wing built at Sloan Kettering called the Evelyn H. Lauder Breast Cancer Center. So early on, she and a woman named Alexandra Penny, who was the editor-in-chief of Self Magazine, came up with the idea of using the pink ribbon as the symbol of breast cancer awareness. So it was a multi-pronged activity, getting her foundation set up and getting the word out. And my job was at that time, after the initial luncheon, to work on getting the word out about the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and the pink ribbon as a symbol for breast cancer awareness. And it just grew and grew and grew, and there's one other very big, wonderful organization called Susan B. Komen, and they're very big and quite wonderful. And the pink ribbon became the symbol all over the world. And, of course, with Lauder having products sold and many companies, I still call it we and us. I feel like it's my alma mater. We have stores all over the world. And so we were able to popularize it by even just having a nice glass bowl of pink ribbons on the counter during Breast Awareness Month, which is October of every year. So it took on a life of its own, very much championed by Mrs. Lauder, who I'm very sad to say passed away several years ago, not of breast cancer, but did enormous work and was quite an advocate and pioneer. And I'm sure we've all known someone who's had this terrible disease. So that was my affiliation with it, and I always am pleased to see how important it is and how much great work that they've done. And I was also with her when she broke ground on this huge facility at Memorial Sloan Kettering. We were there in our hard hats. And so, that, yeah. So there's a serious side to the beauty business.
Well,
we also, the whole industry, the whole industry is involved in something called Look Good, Feel Better, where we would all volunteer our time, people from every company or most companies, to work with cancer patients and do their makeup. Because it's true, when you look good, you do feel better.
Oh, yeah.
And there were certain things that we could do, whether it's, you get back then, a sallow complexion from the drugs. So we could color correct, and there was hair loss, draw in eyebrows, and just laughing and being friendly with women who felt alone and in need of care. There's a good bunch of people in the business.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Phyllis Mojado, author of The Spa at Lavender Lane.
I'll tell you what, when I started reading this, I realized that in order to keep track of things, I needed to make a list of the characters and just a sentence, just a sentence of who they were and so forth, and it really helped. It really did. And
Maybe I should have put that in the book, in the front of the book, like a map that some people do.
I tend to do this with everything that I read because, at my age, I figured it's easy to forget things. And so, this made this more enjoyable because every time we had a new, a character came on the scene, I could look and see exactly a little bit of her background and so forth. And it really was helpful. And I really did enjoy this book. I really did.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that, Carolyn. That's so great. That is so great.
Yeah. You talked a little bit, Phyllis, about,
yes.
We said something about it being multi-character. There was a word you used for that. What was it?
An ensemble.
An ensemble. Yeah. So it's an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
And no one really is kind of the protagonist. You have a number.
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really.
A number of different point
the
of
closest,
view characters.
The closest thing is Tony because she's the first one that's introduced in chapter 2, I believe, if I recall. And we kind of end with her when she's leaving the spa.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but really there is not one. Yeah, she is the first character we meet. And, but it is kind of balanced, and I wanted that to be balanced.
Right. But was it ever difficult? I mean, I found it very easy to distinguish one character from another, but was it ever difficult as you're writing to think, okay, which character should be saying this, which character should be thinking that?
No. The only thing I did sometimes was I kept a list of who just starred in the last chapter. so they'd all get their due. But whatever they were saying was very organic to them as a character, whatever they were saying. There was no chance, for example...
Yeah.
Yeah, that the British assistant spa director would be saying anything that Mavis, the model, would be saying.
right.
Kind of thing. No, they're all very, very different.
Right.
The one that I kind of really am sweet on is Charlotte, the mother.
Yeah.
She's sweet and she's religious, which I'm not, but I respect people who are. And there's something so nice about her, and poor thing. She's going through her second divorce, and she's got this bratty daughter, and she likes her candy, and I don't know.
Yeah.
I feel for her.
Well, I'm not going to be a spoiler, but the ending for that, for her, was one of the best parts of the book, I thought.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Yeah, I
really
wanted
did.
Her to
yeah.
to have a Well, they all have a better future. I'm not sure about Maeve.
Yeah, they do.
She's gonna, if I do, she's going to come up with something that makes her look good. You can be sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, Phyllis, we better have you read before we run out of time.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
All right. So I will read from the beginning only because that tells you about the spa, and which is really a character in the book, and the people who come there. So let me get myself a copy of my book right here. It's so great. Everything my friends always told me, when you hold that book for the first time, it's going to be so incredible. And it was, yeah. Okay. From behind the gilded two-way mirror in her elegant atelier office, Nadia Demidova could monitor everything going on in the sunny reception salon below. Spying on her clients was a questionable tactic, she knew full well, but it had proved to be an extremely useful one nonetheless. She had learned early on during her 25-year reign as mistress of Lavender Lane, one of the world's most exclusive spas, that the difficult guests would reveal themselves practically the moment they arrived. Nadia leaned over and peered through the glass, hoping the new 10-day session would be devoid of problems. Petite, feminine, and still quite attractive at 73, pressing personal issues were making it difficult to muster her legendary client concern. She was in no mood to cater to yet another batch of prima donnas. So far, so good, she thought. Most of the women were already checked in and settled in their rooms. All seemed to be going well, unlike the last session when the wife of an esteemed senator arrived thoroughly inebriated and had to be restrained and sobered up before being driven to the Palm Springs airport and deposited on a flight home. Minor substance abuse was one thing. Many of her clients, most notably the Hollywood types, suffered from such problems. But full-fledged public displays of addiction was quite another. She had created the gold standard for rest, relaxation, and the rejuvenation of mind, body, and spirit. As far as Nadia was concerned, if a client's ability to control her serious self-destructive urges was lacking, she could go straight to the Betty Ford Clinic. She watched as a striking tall woman with cropped jet-black hair swept into the reception salon, followed closely by her driver, struggling with several pieces of Prada luggage. Ah, dear Mavis Perkins, in the latest Armani, of course, with a limited edition Bottega tote over her shoulder. Nadia smiled as she observed the entrance of one of her most regular and most demanding guests. She thought about the time several years before when Mavis had first come to Lavender Lane. After having reigned as a superstar model for years, she had just given up her career to marry Tyler Perkins, one of Chicago's wealthiest and most influential real estate magnates. The stories of how she had persuaded him out of his first marriage were legion, all testaments to her ability to satisfy a man who had been famously satisfied by the best. Mavis was always a favorite topic of gossip among the guests. Her countless affairs, including one with a powerful politician who had his eye on the White House, and, of course, the reckless spending of her husband's seeming limitless money, were juicy fodder for wagging tongues. Although Nadia never encouraged such conversations, the rumor mill almost always extended to her office. Current chat was about Mavis's desire to capitalize on the growing popularity of older models and return to the fashion and beauty scene in a big way. At 52 and still remarkable-looking, she had both the connections and the moxie to make it happen. Indeed, Nadia thought, just what our deprived world truly needs, another dose of Mavis Perkins. She wondered how the grand one would react when told she would not be getting her regular suite. Nadia could already feel the venom. An angelic-faced woman dressed in a hot pink sundress, her head supporting a cascade of blonde curls, entered the salon. Nadia watched as the woman turned repeatedly to the teenager who trailed behind her, long chestnut hair falling below her midriff-bearing T-shirt, skimming the waistline of her cut-off jeans. The girl was tall and thin and a budding beauty. New clients from Dallas, Nadia's assiduously guarded notebook detailed. The depository of all important and personal information, the notebook was locked up in the safe each night and available only to Nadia and her longtime assistant director, Phoebe Bancroft. Only the most rudimentary information was entered in the spa's computers, where it was vulnerable to hackers who, in a heartbeat, would sell her clients' most private information to the highest bidder. Let's see, Nadia sighed. Charlotte Tanner and daughter Lauren Fanning. Mother 42, overweight. Daughter 15, borderline anorexic. They hadn't even begun their stay and were already arguing. She wondered how the pair would survive 10 days sharing a room. Only one woman had yet to arrive. First-time guest, the notebook detailed. Antoinette Etheridge called Tony, 41, single, former buyer, designer sportswear, Gillum's Fifth Avenue. Extremely stressed. Another one, Nadia thought. There had been a growing roster of late of female executives who had made too many personal sacrifices and badly injured themselves, both emotionally and physically, in a relentless quest to make it to the top. She could relate, having given up a great deal in pursuit of her career. Success had not come easily. Nadia felt the familiar flood of fatigue course through her body. She turned away from the mirror, leaning heavily on the arm of her well-worn, violet-tufted Queen Anne chair. The exhaustion that had plagued her in the last few weeks was intruding once again. I cannot afford to be tired now, she sighed to herself. Simply too much to do. Lawyers, papers, Peter. She walked slowly to the large picture window on the far side of her office, the vestiges of an injury sustained many years prior marking her graceful gait. Her damaged ankle was a constant reminder of the life she had once lived and of the different direction her life might have taken had she only had the courage. Nearly 50 years had gone by, but barely a day passed without gut-wrenching remorse. The guilt had recently grown too great to bear. The moment to make amends had finally arrived, and if there were any doubts, time was of the essence. Her diminishing strength served as a constant reminder. Time, she mused, is an adversary to us all. Nadia thought about her dear friend, Dr. Eleanor Franklin, CEO of Franklin Nutritionals. Eleanor must be going mad up there in her suite all alone. She'd have to make time to see her, perhaps have dinner sent up for the two of them. Eleanor had been secluded in her Lavender Lane suite for nearly 3 weeks, recent plastic surgery having not quite delivered the hoped-for results. She assured Nadia she had gone to the very best, and yet, 21 days after the operation, she still had that pulled and pinched look when she fully expected to look rested and refreshed. The doctor promised it would ease up, but as each day went by, Eleanor feared she would remain looking more like some older sister of the late Joan Rivers than her former attractive 55-year-old self. Nadia looked out the window and drank in the view of the lush Coachella Valley. It was especially beautiful in early spring, with the hills drenched in brightly colored wildflowers and the blue sky shining brilliantly behind centuries-old Segura cacti. She watched as a roadrunner darted its way across the field, crown feathers forging ahead like a sentinel in the warm April air. Soon he would be joined by owls, hawks, hares, and jackrabbits, all answering the valley's seductive call. She was tempted to stand there and look out all day, but it was hardly an option with a business to run. Lest she forget, the dreaded intercom buzzed to remind her. She returned to her desk reluctantly, certain the summons would mean only problems. What is it, she asked, trying not to allow the fatigue to color her voice. As to be expected, Phoebe reported in her distinctive British voice, the difficult ones are showing their colors. Nadia smiled at Phoebe's choice of words, language commonly used to describe the aggressive mating behavior of male creatures in the wild. Her clients were indeed like the inhabitants of the Palm Springs desert, each with her own agenda and unique survival techniques. Her assistant was a treasure. She always managed to put things in perspective. There's a situation which needs your attention, Phoebe whispered into the phone. Yes, Nadia said, looking down below. Mavis appears to be in fine fettle, but nothing that can't be handled. I'll be right with you. As mistress of Lavender Lane, Nadia Demidova had managed to tame scores of situations. This would be just one more. She smoothed her neatly coiffed silver-gray hair, took a few deep breaths, and made her way toward the discreet staircase that would deliver her to the concerns unfolding in the arena below.
And that's and the end
one.
Of the chapter.
Yes.
That's a great beginning. It is.
Thank you. Now, I'll tell you a secret.
Okay.
Yes. This, I went to a writer's conference a very long time ago, and I wrote the first paragraph or two in that conference and then put the idea away. And I remember because a couple of people in the group, they didn't know what an atelier was. And I just recently heard from someone from that conference. This was the Maui Writers Conference. Her name is Kelly, and she said, I still remember that nobody knew what an atelier was. Now they will.
And what is an atelier?
So,
what is an
atelier? It's a studio. It's just French for studio, and it's a commonly used word in fashion. And they were right. They shouldn't know what it is. It's a kind of an esoteric word. So
there's a theme throughout the book of second chances. Why is this
an
important theme for you?
Well, because it's exactly what I've done. You know, I left this extraordinary job, which a lot of women would give their eye teeth for, because I wanted to write. It was always something that I wanted to do as I got older. And it was a really hard decision to make. As I said, it was a family company. I love them. They were good to me. I worked very, very hard for them, and I am proud of the job I did there. And it was very, very hard to leave. And my best friends to this day are still people that I knew from Estee Lauder. Indeed, they gave me a Zoom on the night my book reading was supposed to have been on the day of publication. We had a Zoom, and all my many of my Estee Lauder friends were on that Zoom. So it was. So this is a second chance for me, and so it was important. And I think a lot of people do want to do more than one thing during their lifetime, and there are women who have failed in relationships the first time, or didn't accomplish what they wanted to, or found that there was something different they wanted in life as they went along. So it was a theme, without question, yes.
Now,
and personal to me, as you saw.
You mentioned that when you started writing full-time, you didn't become successful right away. You wrote a book.
Oh, my goodness. Can
books.
I tell you about my failures?
Yeah.
Oh, there was also two screenplays, one of which I signed a option agreement for. That means when you give the right to another entity, whether it's a producer, a production company, or whatever, to take your work and then try to have it produced and made into a film. So I signed that agreement with a small company. It was a partnership of two women who had an agreement with the Dick Clark Company, which was a big deal 15 years or so ago.
Sure.
And I had the fabled breakfast at the Polo Lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel. I mean, I really thought I was going to have a movie, and then that too fell apart. So there was that, and then the book that I spent 4 years writing. And the only thing I can tell you is that I very much love to write, and I have a lot of stick-to-itiveness. And there was a writer who wrote a book about writing many years ago, and I think it was the first writing book I may have read while I was, even before Estee Lauder, I think. And her name was Phyllis, as it turned out, Phyllis Whitney. I don't know if you know that name, but I've always had tacked up on my bulletin board, never mind the rejections, the discouragement, the voices of ridicule, there can be those too. Work and wait and learn, and that train will come by. If you give up, you'll never have a chance to climb aboard.
Oh.
I've kept that up there for a really long time.
Wow.
And it's, I think some people give up too quickly, but it was something that I had to do. I wanted to do it, and I'm fortunate that I've been able to do it. I'm comfortable, and...
You know, Phyllis, I'm curious why, with the book that you had a publisher and then they backed out, did you think to take it to somewhere else?
No. I don't know. I don't think I had that much self-confidence then, or I got started on the other one. I don't remember quite what. But I did. That was the basis of the... Oh, I know what it was. That was... The screenplay was based on that book.
Okay.
But I changed it significantly. But the core of the story was the same. And it was about someone in the cosmetic business. They say, you know, write what you know. So
absolutely.
But the book I wrote, the other book I wrote, which took me several years, was about something I didn't know. And I learned a lot from it. It's a true story. And I'm rewriting it now as a novel. So... It will be very different from this one.
Is that the one that on your website that you talk about, Anthony and Bridget.
And that is based. That's a working title. I'm not sure what it will be. It's based on a true story. I wrote it as a first person account in Anthony's voice. And we both liked it very much. That's why I had to make those trips abroad. And we both liked it very much. And then the family of the young woman involved was having a problem with feeling that they would be upset by it or whatever. So we put it aside, and it's a wonderful story, and I had just started to rewrite it when I sold The Spot, Lavender Lane, and had to throw myself into, getting an agent and getting a publisher, as you know, is not a slam dunk.
Right.
So, I work as hard now as I did when I was in the corporate world. I am at my computer by 8:30 every morning, and I mean, I don't even know there's a quarantine on, because I've been living like this. The only thing is I miss seeing my friends in the evening, but as far as the daytimes, it's pretty much the same.
Well, you must be thrilled to have the book in your hand now.
I am. I really, really am. It's really, it's exciting.
It
and
is wonderful. And Phyllis, we're out
I have
of time.
To encourage any... Oh, my goodness. This has been a lot of fun. I was worried that I'd clam up, but I guess I didn't.
No worries.
Can I leave you with one more thought?
Sure.
Yeah, that is it's a quote that I saw from the good witch, Glenda in The Wizard of Oz. You
Perfect.
Always had the power, my dear. You just had to find it for yourself.
And Mom, do you have a quote for us to close to?
Yeah, I do, actually. Friends are the family that you make, enriching your life.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed they are. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Phyllis, for being with us today. And
thank you both very much.
Thank you, all our listeners, and see you next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye, everybody.